Here's what's coming up in the Category5.tv newsroom. Thousands of Disney Plus accounts are already up for sale on hacking forums. IoT doorbell Ring had a bug in its configuration app, which sent Wi-Fi set information unencrypted to some doorbell devices, exposing customers' home networks. GitHub will preserve open source code in an Arctic vault. Stick around, the full details are coming up later in the show.
This is the Category5.tv newsroom, covering the week's top tech stories with a slight Linux bias.
I'm Sasha Rickman, joined this week by Jeff Weston and also Robbie Ferguson. He's just offset.
I am over here somewhere.
All right, some quick honorable mentions this week. A new AI is combining machine learning and computer vision to detect drowning people in real time using object recognition. It's able to tell if a person is swimming normally or if they're at risk of drowning. What's best is that the drowning detection is open source and can run on a single board computer, such as a Raspberry Pi. A secretive clean energy company backed by Bill Gates has created a way to use mirrors and artificial intelligence to harness the heat of the sun, replacing the need to use fossil fuels heat applications, and cut back on CO2 emissions. This invention creates concentrated solar energy so hot that they can manufacture steel, glass, and cement with a carbon-free source that has not been available before.
Let's get into the top stories we're following this week. Thousands of Disney Plus accounts are already up for sale on hacking forums. Disney's hotly anticipated streaming service Disney Plus finally launched this week. Despite being open to the public for just a few days, hackers have already hijacked thousands of accounts and put them up for sale on the dark web. The going rate for a hacked account appears to be somewhere between $3 and $5. That's 3 to 4 times more than the asking price for a hacked Netflix account. Logical enough, given the excitement around the Disney Plus launch. So, yeah, I'm not really all that surprised, to be honest with you.
You know, I watched the big hype of Disney Plus, and the first thing I thought was, I have no desire to put any money into this.
Into Disney Plus. Oh, wow.
I can see the draw. Like, I actually want to see all, I want to see all of the things on it. I just don't want to pay for it.
Well, I mean, I get the appeal. You have all the classic Disney stuff, but you also have Star Wars and Marvel and all that kind of stuff built in, which, you know, for somebody who's a big movie buff, that's exactly what you're looking for.
Right.
And for somebody who has young kids, I could see the appeal to say, hey, you know, my kids can watch this and it's great. But at the same time, I'm going, I already have Netflix.
Yeah.
I already have other streaming services. Yeah. I have no desire to throw money at Disney for something else.
That's really tough.
It is. Like, you got that, young kids, Robbie. What
I'm,
are you?
Well, I'm the voice over here, folks. So, but the truth is, isn't it tough, I think, for content creators and distributors these days? Because, like, Disney needs their platform, and Netflix needs their platform, Amazon Prime needs their platform, but I'm not a, like Jeff, you say, I'm not about to subscribe to every platform.
Right.
I just want the Orville and, yes. like, yes. the morning show. Like, how do I get these on one platform? Because right now, that's the challenge for us consumers. And I think that the creators, the content creators, have to come up with the solution where, like, am I going to subscribe to Hulu and Amazon Prime? I'm in a great situation where Amazon Prime also gives me free shipping. So
I do want to ask a question about the security of the situation.
Yeah.
Because the real story is that hackers have hijacked all of the accounts.
Okay, reality goes, yeah.
Right?
But that's not them hacking Disney Plus. That's people who have really bad security on their computers and their home networks and are probably using the same password from the same email. And, I mean, let's be clear. Chances are the majority of Disney Plus users and subscribers are more than likely families that often have tons of accounts for their kids and everything, and you're going to recycle passwords. Hmm. Like, I think that's what this story is about, is people not being careful with their passwords and the software on their computers. And I think that's what it is.
So couldn't Disney Plus not have one of those password strength things that other places have?
What good is that, yeah. Sasha, if you already have the same password on Twitter and Facebook and your banking and your email account? So doesn't it come down to we have to have a password manager so that we can generate a fresh password for every single subscription that we have online?
That is exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that you're going to get those passwords out there.
What probably people are doing is using their same password for Disney Plus as they are for Netflix and like.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, well, exactly.
So compromise one and you get access to all of them. Am I right?
And on top of that, most people are going to be playing this on their smart TVs and their other streaming devices. And so the likelihood of them logging in and logging off and logging in and it's not going to happen. They're going to log in on their device. Yeah. They're going to recognize it. They're going to approve it. And they're not going to pay attention to the account for however long.
Right.
And so if you've got, you know, 100 other people who have purchased their login information for $3, they have no clue. And so
while
you're paying the monthly fees, they're sitting there going, I spent $3.
Right.
I gave up my coffee at Starbucks today, and I'm watching Disney Plus forever.
True.
That is,
and does that really matter to me as a consumer who's paying for that service? It's like the stolen cable of our childhood, where it's like, do I really care? I'm paying for it, but you know who has access to it? And so we're talking about somebody stealing our access. They don't have access to our personal confidential data, I hope, but they have access to our accounts.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's really interesting.
She says.
I feel like I would just assume that Disney Plus would do one of those password strength things.
But that is useless if you've got a really strong password that you use for all your sites. I mean, it used to be you could put a password in, and then it was, it's got to be 6 characters. Now it's got to be 8 characters. By the way, you need to use capitals and small letters.
Yes.
Oh, now you need punctuation. It's like, come on.
Now you need a 32-bit signed algorithmic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I'm surprised, though, that for the fact that, I mean, you go to, like, on a Disney cruise or anything like that, Disney's all about security and family protection.
This is the thing.
I'm a little bit shocked that they don't have two-factor authentication for their service.
Don't they? Do you know that they don't?
They might have it as an option.
I don't know, so maybe I'm just speaking gibberish, but
maybe that's what we need to look for.
Two FA
is the answer all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
all right, we've got to take a quick break. The Crypto Report and more of this week's top tech stories are coming up. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back. Okay, let's take a quick look at the cryptocurrency report as it shows on our website, category5.tv. Now, this week, the Bitcoin currency is down. I mean, $574 down. It's on its decline. Is that going to persist? I don't know. Nobody does. That's the thing. Okay, Facebook Libra, still not trading. Litecoin, I mean, everything is down. Litecoin is down at $55.99. So we're talking a loss of $5.46, which for a coin that's less than $60 in value, that's a pretty big percentage loss. $177 for the Ethereum coin, down $8.85. Monero is also down. Scala is down. Turtle coin is also down. I mean, everything is on the decline right now, but what affects that? And the thing that we try to reiterate here at Category 5 Technology TV is that there is no knowing how the cryptocurrency market is going to flow. And so you just have to be ready for it. And by being ready for it, we suggest that you only invest what you can afford to lose. It's very possible that you could lose everything that you invest. It's very possible as well that it could increase in value. We really don't know because the cryptocurrency market is always open. It never closes. And it's extremely volatile. I'm going to head back over to the newsroom. Sasha, what do you got for us?
IoT doorbell Ring had a bug in its configuration app, which sent Wi-Fi setup information unencrypted to some doorbell devices, exposing customers' home networks. Researchers from Bitdefender notified Ring in June of a flaw in Ring Video Doorbell Pro camera's software that made it possible for wireless eavesdroppers to grab the Wi-Fi credentials of customers during the device's setup, because those credentials were sent over an unsecured Wi-Fi connection to the device using unencrypted HTTP. An attacker could take advantage of this bug by forcing a victim to reconfigure the doorbell. The attacker could use a Wi-Fi deauthorization or DAuth attack against the device to make it re-enter configuration mode, and could use a malicious Wi-Fi device to make the Ring doorbell drop off its network. The doorbell's owner would then have to notice that the doorbell is disconnected, which may require the attacker or someone else to ring the doorbell before the targeted owner realizes the doorbell is offline. When the doorbell is put back into configuration mode, the app will offer to reconnect the doorbell to the Wi-Fi network and then resend the credentials to the doorbell in an HTTP message encoded in XML. The attacker would then be able to connect to the victim's home Wi-Fi network if there are no other security measures in place to stop them, such as device whitelisting or partitioning of the Wi-Fi network. All affected devices should now be patched, according to Ring and Bitdefender. But this is another example of why owners of Internet of Things devices should consider using Wi-Fi routers capable of segmenting networks or offering guest Wi-Fi networks that restrict access by connected devices to the internet only. And DAuth attacks can still be used to knock these devices offline, allowing a burglar or porch pirate to cover their tracks by disabling video recording.
That's a whole lot of work you have to go through to make it happen.
But once you get good at it, I'm sure you just do it, right?
I guess. I mean, so, I'm glad that they jumped on it quickly, though.
Right.
Which is good.
Yeah, exactly. So there's those doorbells, right, that just do like the 30-second video recording when the doorbell rings.
Right.
But then there's also like motion detecting door. Like there's so many different Internet of Things devices out there that the story doesn't even just speak to the Ring doorbell as much as like the smart fridges.
IoT in general.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, like, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right. So the guest Wi-Fi or the whitelisted routers.
Yes. Yep. Right. So that's how I have my network set at home, is I have all of my devices whitelisted. Once I connect them,
smart,
I log them in and nothing else can connect. So, I mean, if somebody comes by the house and they're like, hey, I want to connect. Sorry, not going to happen. Here's the guest net.
Yeah.
Because the guest net it's segmented off. From
right.
my home Wi-Fi, all of my devices are protected. They are whitelisted. And if something shows up on trying to get in that's not on the whitelist, I start going on a fishing expedition to find out what it is.
Yeah. Right.
So, Jeff, could you similarly set up a guest Wi-Fi connection for your IoT devices so that things like smart fridges and smart devices are all connected to their own private VLAN?
Well, my router only allows for your home network and then your guest net. So, I mean, I could, and I could password my guest net and make it so that nobody can join. So
okay.
I could put my IoT things on the guest net,
yeah.
and that way they're all segmented off into that, and then have all my home computers and devices on my regular Wi-Fi network. So
that's
I could
cool.
split it off that way.
Yeah.
Right.
But then it means that anybody who's coming to the house, sorry, they're not using the Wi-Fi.
Okay, sure. Fair enough. But having something more sophisticated like, say, a MikroTik router,
sure.
something like that where you can set up multiple VLANs, that makes a lot of sense in this scenario so that your visitors, your guests can use Wi-Fi because the kids' friends are going to ask to use the Wi-Fi when they want to play Roblox on their devices, right?
Right.
That's how it works. But the fact is I don't want them to have access to my LAN servers.
Right.
What if their laptop has a ransomware deployment running that is going to encrypt anything that it finds on a network as soon as they connect. We don't have any control over that, but what we do have control over is segmenting the Wi-Fi in such a way that they only have access to the internet and not our internal LAN servers. And that's thinking about ransomware, but also thinking about the fact that, hey, kids are smart these days. I don't want them having access to my personal files either.
So are there different levels of routers? Like you said, yours just has the main and then the guest. Is there like Internet of Things routers where you have like a ton of different segments?
Does it come down to consumer versus commercial?
Yeah. Right.
But MikroTik is a very happy medium, and I use MikroTik as an example because we don't have to go to the $4,000 Cisco. We can just go with a $500 MikroTik and get the same features as that $4,000 Cisco. That's what's mind-blowing about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't even spent that much on my home router. Like, I think our router was about $250.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was on the high end of your, you know, typical consumer gear. But one of the other things that now that I'm thinking about the router, I could have four different segments to it because I also have the two different bands, the 2.4 and the 5 gig.
Right.
Oh, so okay. Yeah, those, you could utilize that.
I can have a guest and my home network. So I could, in theory, I do have access to four different bands.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because we've got a bungalow, the 5 gig doesn't quite reach the whole house. Because it is a shorter range,
mm-hmm.
but the 2.4 does. Easily
offer
enough.
That one to the kids.
Well, it's funny. I mean, when we upgrade, like when my wife and I upgrade our phones, we'll give our kids the old phones, but then they've got the old phone that they no longer use for Wi-Fi and whatnot. But I will pull those off the whitelist because they're still in the home. They, you know, they've got an old game on it, whatever. But what I don't want is some, you know, issue with the software where there's a vulnerability because they're no longer updating it. I don't want it accessing our network, so I'll pull those right off.
That's great forward thinking, actually.
I'm telling you, I'm not just a pretty face.
Wow.
And Robbie's going, you're not even that.
You guys.
All right, off to Sasha, shall we?
Yes. GitHub will preserve open source code in an Arctic vault. GitHub has announced its plans to launch the Arctic Code Vault with the aim to preserve open source software for future generations for at least 1,000 years. The code sharing site is partnering with the Long Now Foundation, the Internet Archive, the Software Heritage Foundation, Arctic World Archive, Microsoft Research, the Bodleian Library, and Stanford Libraries to ensure the long-term preservation of the world's open source software. The GitHub announcement states, quote, "There is a long history of lost technologies from which the world would have benefited, as well as abandoned technologies which we found unexpected new uses," end quote. The company plans to store and preserve open source software like Flutter and TensorFlow in an abandoned coal mine in Norway, 250 meters deep in the permafrost of an Arctic mountain. GitHub stores its data on specialized ultra-durable film, which is coated in iron oxide powder. This data can be read by a computer or a human with a magnifying glass in case of a global power outage. Remarkably, this film is said to last for 1,000 years. The Norwegian tech company that makes the special film said that they might even last for up to 2,000 years if stored in a cool, dry, and low-oxygen cave. Among the first data deposits, open source software codes can be stored at the vault included the Linux and Android operating systems and 6,000 other important open source applications. GitHub is preparing to capture a snapshot of every active public repository on February 2nd, 2020, and preserve that data in the Arctic Code Vault. The snapshot will include public code repositories as well as significant dormant repositories. As if that's not impressive enough, GitHub is also working on Microsoft's Project Silica to archive all active public repositories for over 10,000 years by writing them into quartz glass platters with lasers. This is awesome. This is awesome.
It's a very interesting story. It reminds me of, is it called the NOAA Project? There's that vault where they're storing all of the seeds.
Right. Yeah.
It's kind of like that. But what's interesting is they've given a date.
What I like about the date, and I have to say this, and I know that binary is like
so
zeros
arbitrary.
And ones,
right?
But they gave February the 2nd, 2020, so it's 0202-2020.
Oh, yes. I didn't even catch that. That's amazing, Sasha. Well done.
I do like that. But what I'm sitting here going, okay, so you've announced a date.
Yes.
And if I'm, quite frankly, a social jerk and want to like upload a repository of like viruses and all this kind of stuff under open source, that's the day I'm going to make sure that I've got a repository out there of bad stuff.
Oh, Jeff. The dark side. Well, you'll be stored in a cave for 10,000 years or 1,000 years or something.
Yes, but I mean, this is the world we live in.
This is how he thinks, folks.
Yeah, except okay.
February 2nd?
So here's
I'd better make some viruses.
So we're going to be, in like 2,000 years, we're going to be down in this cave. And by we, I don't mean me. But we're going to be down in the cave.
The open source version of you, Sasha.
That's right.
Sasha 2.0.
With a magnifying glass because we have a global shortage. And I'm going to be like, oh, good, good, good. Oh, no, Jeff was here.
I didn't say I'm the bad guy. I just, you know, putting it out there, I think you open up the door for people going, oh, I'm going to put, you know, that out there. I mean, the cool thing about it, though, is you also have people going, hold on, my repository is going to be categorized on that day. I better make sure it's good. It looks good.
No. Make sure the readmes are just right.
That's right.
Yeah.
Anybody with a misspelling mistake is going to be like, oh, they just archived that for 1,000 years.
I know, right? 10,000 years, Jeff.
I love this because it makes like digital, like tangible, right?
Yeah.
Whereas like, I was watching a documentary on the film industry and how it's going digital and they're doing away with film. And now if the technology shifts and changes, there's not going to be a way to access the archives of our films.
Right.
So now I want them to hear this story and use this same iron oxide cool film stuff and find another cave and we can just save all of our goods.
You're such a happy person.
Yes.
No disagreement there, right?
Big thanks to Roy W. Nash and our community of viewers for submitting stories to us this week. Thanks for watching the Category5.tv newsroom. Don't forget to like and subscribe for all your tech news with a slight Linux bias. And if you appreciate what we do, become a patron at patreon.com/newsroom. From the Category5.tv newsroom, I'm Sasha Rickman.
And I'm Robbie Ferguson.
And I'm Jeff Weston.